counties with her.
Okay, y'all. We're calling the afternoon session to order. I know this is the event that a lot of y'all have come to hear. We had a full day up here, so we're gonna move forward. My name is Dale Rosengarten. I work in Special Collections at the College of Charleston, curator of the Jewish Heritage Collection, and have been working on this family history roadshow for the last couple of months. By way of introduction, we've just heard the future is here. Unfortunately, Steve Cohen is no longer here. So whatever we say here, unfortunately, he won't be able to respond to. But what I wanted to tell him is the future may be here, but the past is never dead. It's not even past. And I know that by having worked in South Carolina for the last 20 years on a project of collecting people's histories. It may be different in New York, but in South Carolina, we don't just move into the future, we drag our past with us. And if we didn't, I wouldn't have a job, and neither would Alyssa Neely, my associate here, so I'm thankful for that. The other thing I think Steve kind of perhaps is not aware of in South Carolina, the whole issue of continuity, Jewish continuity, from my experience, goes hand in hand with this remarkable acceptance that Jews have experienced in this part of the country, which has led to a great deal of intermarriage and even passing out of Judaism, but not passing away from Judaism. And I think on our panel, and you'll hear from numerous people whose stories, you know, they may not be Jewish, but indeed they're very, very in tune, and in some cases, the leading historians of their family. So that's an interesting twist, I think, on some of what we heard earlier. At our meeting in Florence in the fall, I found out that Mark Wahlberg is a member of the tribe. Indeed, he's from Florence, and I thought I could therefore steal Antiques Roadshow and call our exhibit over at the library Family History Roadshow. And it really is has the similar gestalt. It's really everybody's stuff from the attic and the closet and the drawers. I can't wait till everybody here comes and sees the exhibit, and some of our panelists have already been to the library, but some haven't. It's a beautiful show, and we are creating a digital version. So within, I'd say, 4 to 6 weeks, you'll be able to relive the Family History Roadshow online, and we'll make sure that everybody knows about that through our email lists. The organizing principle was very simple. We just chose new treasures from the collection, things that have recently been donated to the Jewish Heritage Collection that, as a historian, I find remarkable, telling, funny, lots of reasons for including them. There's no real exhibit narrative. It's not telling exactly a story. It's organized around families. And I've had an incredible privilege of working with the donors, the people who gave us all of this remarkable stuff, as collaborators on the issue of the newsletter that all of you have in your packet. Many of the people on this panel were contributors. They wrote text for the newsletter, and some of those texts are now in the exhibit. The amount of engagement, I'll call it, of those people and basically the family members who've offered to be on this panel is remarkable. I would almost say unprecedented. I mean, people are so eager to participate. And I can say from my experience as a curator of a portion of the people 10 years ago, and now this, albeit smaller exhibit, Family History Roadshow, that there's something kind of almost a chemical reaction when you put these objects, these family heirlooms, on display in exhibits, in pictures, in magazines, if you in any way kind of elevate them to the to a public forum. They take on new meaning for the families themselves. And I hope some of our panelists talk a little bit about that, but I've seen it with my own eyes. You know, some scrap, some letter, some little broken picture that could have gotten thrown away suddenly becomes an icon of something much more important. And that's why I love being a curator. It really is. These histories are embedded in things, and the things are passed from generation to generation. So from my perspective, they're part of Jewish continuity. People may pass, but the things that they leave behind carry some of their history, some of their message forward. Today's panel, we've got a lot of people up here. As I say, these are all either descendants or historians of some of these families, not all of the families featured in the roadshow. We're going to start with Barry Baker at the end. I'm not even going to introduce people. I'm going to let them introduce themselves. I'm asking each panelist to talk for 3 to 5 minutes about what they know about their family history, how they know it, and most important, what it means to them. And then pass the mic to the next speaker. I guess I'll say hold your questions for the end, but if you have something urgent, shout it out. In the audience are lots of their mishpacha, so I know you're going to have things you want to say, and I do hope we have a very free dialogue. Karen Franklin is co-moderator and timekeeper. At 3 minutes, she will hold up her sign and say, you've got no more than 2 minutes left. I urged her not to use the barking dog on her cell phone, but she might have to institute that. And at the end, you know, where I reckon this will take about 50 minutes to an hour, we will have another 20 or 30 minutes to talk back and forth and share stories. And then the conversation will continue over at Addlestone. There is transportation, I understand, and it's an easy walk. If anyone doesn't know where Addlestone is, you can look in your program. There's a little map, but it's close by. So Barry, please start.
Barry Baker is my name, and it's pretty hard to ask the lawyer to just speak for 5 minutes. But well, I'm just going to stand up. Maybe you can hear me better. Barry Baker is my name. I'm going to speak about my, you know, family. My grandfather, Morris Baker, came to America from Russia in 1909. He settled in Charleston in 1910. He became a peddler, but spent a lot of his time in Monk's Corner. And from a peddler, he got an interest in, you know, cattle. And he started buying and selling, you know, cattle. By 1914, he'd saved enough money that he was able, you know, to bring to this country my grandmother, my father, my Aunt Sophie, and my cousin, you know, Mary. And they thereafter had 5 more children, a total of 7 children. One of the children is, you know, still living, and she just had a birthday and turned 39. So, Aunt Ruthie, if you'd kindly stand up, I'm going to just acknowledge that. Papa, you know, from being with the cattle, eventually opened up 6 non-kosher meat markets. Then he opened up a kosher market in 1938 at the corner of King and Spring Streets. He eventually opened up another, eventually moved the kosher market to 556 King, across from Altman's Furniture Company, where, you know, Charlie Altman's uncles and father, ran a business. And with all of that, my grandfather was also in the wholesale, you know, meat business. And my father decided in the late, I think, 30s to work with his father. And they then, for the first time, had an actual, you know, office for the wholesale, company. And it was my father, my uncle Frank Klein, and my grandfather. And they formed a company called M. Baker and our sons. And according to my aunt, you know, Ruthie, it was just an excellent business. But my father realized that he was limited because Charleston did not have a privately owned, you know, a slaughterhouse. You had to go to the city market at a certain time. You could only kill X number of, like, you know, cattle. And so according to my aunt, you know, Ruthie, my daddy had a close friend, Mr. Ray Waits, according to my mother, it was my grandfather, that encouraged my father to open up the first privately owned slaughterhouse in Charleston. And when you think about it, and I didn't think about it until this past week, it was quite an undertaking. Because first he had to, you know, find the land, and he had to buy 17 acres of land in North Charleston, you know, which he did. And you can imagine, I mean, they had to, I mean, actually, like, you know, start from scratch and build this, you know, plant that had to be in, you know, compliance with state and federal, you know, health regulations. Well, my daddy also realized that if he was going to have, you know, a slaughterhouse, he had to have the cattle. And even though he was active in the Charleston Livestock Growers Association and he bought cattle all over the Charleston County, that was not enough. So that meant that he and Pop and Uncle Frank had to buy a farm. So Daddy thereafter, you know, bought a farm on John's Island, you know, a cottage, a plantation, and he became a cattle farmer. And anyway, from there, the business, you know, grew by leaps and bounds until tragedy struck in 1955. Now, my father died expected because he had a heart attack. He died on May 21st, 1955. And it was like a Greek, you know, tragedy or like a nail in a coffin, but exactly 2 to 3 weeks after his death, we get a call at like 3 o'clock in the morning, and it's Uncle Frank. The whole, you know, plant is on fire except the administrative offices. My daddy was the heart and soul of M. Baker & Sons. Everybody knew that without him, it was going to be pretty hard for the business to continue. But with the combination of his death and the fire, unfortunately, the business, you know, closed in 1957. Thank you very much.
I'm Jane Pearlstein Meyerson. Is this on?
That's on. It's supposed to be on. My brother's not very good with electronics. Yeah, it's on.
Okay.
Jane, hold it right up close to your
okay.
mouth.
I have a weak voice. I'm Jane Pearlstein Meyerson, and I've been a Meyerson now almost 60 years, but I'm still a Pearlstein. Like Dale said, you bring your history with you. And I'm a fifth generation Pearlstein, and I'm excited to be a part of history now. Yesterday I went to the exhibit and saw the marvelous exhibit, and I really actually remembered so many of the subjects. So that was fun for us. Being a fifth generation Pearlstein in Charleston is a bonanza. I asked my seventh generation granddaughter, Jennifer Kleiman, who's moved back here, what it means to her. And she said it gives her a feeling of belonging, and not just being someone who was plopped down here. I guess it gives you confidence also. The Pearlstein, South Carolina saga began in 1854 when Tonkham, later Thomas Pearlstein, arrived in America from Poland with his 10-year-old son, I.M., who was Isaac Mayer Pearlstein. The Pearlstein business has been through so many metamorphoses over the last 159 years. They started out making corn cob buttons for Confederate uniforms. And over the years, they had a buggy and a carriage business that was later hay and grain, and then hardware and on to wholesale groceries and beverages that evolved into the Anheuser-Busch distributorship for Pearlstein distributors. As Susan, my niece Susan Pearlstein, and my brother Edwin Pearlstein are here today, and as Susan just told me, Pearlstein's has had so many incarnations that the recent sale of Pearlstein distributors didn't seem like an end, but like another beginning. And I think she's right. I remember taking my second grade class at James Simmons School to the warehouse, which was then at the corner of East Bay and Cumberland, where the Lodge Alley Inn is now. And on the top floor of the warehouse, we had a flour mill, and that was, everybody was covered with flour. I still remember that. I.M. Pearlstein & Sons was the first corporation in Charleston County. and it's still in existence in Charleston County. It is owned by my first cousin, Milton Pearlstein's daughter, Marianne Aberman of Rock Hill, and the children of her deceased sister, Barbara Lamell. I am Pearlstein had three wives, and that gave us a myriad of relatives all over South Carolina. His first two sons were Hyman and Shep, and Hyman's wife, my grandmother, Esther Strauss Pearlstein, was born in Maysville, which is a suburb of Sumter. Her mother was a Weinberg. When I was a little girl, we used to go visit relatives in Branchville, St. Matthews, Allendale, Darlington, etc., etc. And I was going to ask Sylvia, I remember a blue-eyed Weinberg, and she was called that because she had one blue eye and one brown eye, and she was from Darlington, right, Sylvia?
And she was Kendra Mortimer Weinberg in Sumter, and she married Goza.
Right, and she was, I remember she was a great horsewoman, I think.
She did race horses.
Thomas Pearlstein, the first one who came over here, was a founder of Synagogue BSBI here in Charleston. And my father, people don't believe this, but because we're such big KKBE members now, but he was bar mitzvahed at the synagogue and the temple. The family was always involved in the Jewish community and the greater Charleston community. My brother Edwin and his daughters and son-in-law, Susan and Jan and Larry Lipoff, are well known for all their wonderful contributions of money, service, and ideas to so many Charleston institutions. We are rooted in the past, but we are blooming in the present, and we're looking forward to the future in this wonderful community. I was told to talk a little bit about family artifacts. Well, on your way to the library on Cumming Street, across from the side of the Addlestone Library, there's some beautiful wrought iron gates that were donated to the College of Charleston by my Aunt Mary Hornick. They had been at my grandmother Pearlstein's house at Rutledge and Bogart Streets, and when it was sold, they took the gates. Philip Simmons, the famous iron maker, told me once how fond he was of my grandfather Hyman. When Mr. Simmons made all the iron sides for Pearlstein's flatbed trucks. And so I guess he didn't just make gates, but utilitarian things also. Edwin and Barbara donated a house to the Hope Lodge complex. These major artifacts and the collection that I donated to the college archives bring us pride and comfort and also a feeling of relief. Let me end by thanking Marty and Dale and Harlan and others for the magnificent contributions they have made to the South Carolina Jewish population, and to put in a plug to all of you to consider donating materials to this important archive. It is such a positive thing to do. And thank you for including me in this panel.
Thank you for the, my name is Sylvia Weinberg Clark, and I thank you for the opportunity to be here today to represent the Levi family, even as an in-law. When I married Jillian Weinberg in 1958, I had no idea. I just didn't know much about the family, but I learned a lot about the Levi family during the years. Jillian passed away in 1999, and I married Bob Clark, who is with me here today, in 2002. However, I was caretaker of the Weinberg Levi. I was resident caretaker of the Weinberg Levi Museum, as we affectionately called our home. And the portraits of Hannah and Moses Levi that were in the magazine and are in the exhibit were on my dining room wall as I sat around an oak trestle table that was probably 150 years old by then. Very proud to have been there. My son and his family now live in the home, and his wife is doing a wonderful job of taking care of things. I researched a great deal about Manning and Clarendon County after my retirement, and my research culminated in two books, A History of Clarendon County and a History of the Downtown Manning Area. And through this research, I learned a great deal about the importance of the Moses Levi family. Moses Levi was patriarch of a large family, and many of us here today are relatives of him, and contributed so much to the town. In 1895, the first public school for Manning was built. Within a few years, the money had simply run out. The building was about to be, the building and lot were about to be foreclosed on. The school was going to close, and Moses Levi's family stepped up, bought the land, paid off the mortgage, renamed the school the Moses Levi Institute, and for 10 years they subsidized the school, and it operated. That was the only public school in Manning. In 1910, South Carolina made devised school districts that could raise money by taxes, and so at that point the citizens of Manning levied taxes upon themselves, and the big large wooden building that had been the Moses Levi Institute was moved across town and was the school for the black children. And a new two-story brick building was built on the site. And so it served as a school from 1910 until 1982, when a new high school was built. Any rate, if you're in the Manning area, next Tuesday afternoon at 5:30, we're dedicating a historical monument commemorating the early Manning schools, and Dr. Wendell Levi from Sumter is sponsoring this marker. We also, in 1910, the Levi family donated a land and $1,000 to begin a public library in Manning. And money was raised from other citizens to do that. The library was built. It now serves as the Clarendon County Historical History Center and Archives. Excuse me. But from 1910 until 1982, that was the only library in Manning, in fact, in Clarendon County, until a new one was built. So we really have a lot to thank the Levi family for. Moses Levi came to this country in 1948 at the age of 21. He was one of that large group of Jews who came following the revolution in Germany, moved to Sumter. 5 years later, the lovely Hannah Jekyll, or Jacobs as she's called, as the family is called now, joined him. They married and moved to Sumter. Well, in 1856, Clarendon County was carved out of a portion, the eastern portion of Sumter County, and Manning was determined to be the county seat. So Moses Levi began one of the first businesses there, and was the pioneer merchant in Manning, and was contributed a tremendous amount to the economic growth of the community. And I know my time is up. It's getting there. I'll do a quick thing. Moses, in 1863, joined the Civil War as a private with Sprott's Guards. He left a wife, 5 young children, and a thriving business to put his life on the line for his new homeland, which I think is remarkable. And 3 things happened in 1 week in April that affected him and many of us. First of all, he was with the group in Petersburg, Virginia, that lost the battle, and they were taken as prisoners of war to Point Lookout in Maryland. 2 days later, part of the infamous Sherman's March to the Sea came through Clarendon County. General Potter's group, raiders, came there, burned almost everything in town, including the courthouse, the Moses Levi building, and the cotton warehouse that had all of his things in it, and many homes. 2 days after that, Lee surrendered to Grant at Appomattox. Very quickly there. You would think that the prisoners of war would have been freed immediately. They were not. They devised a plan by whereby the prisoners of war would be released state by state in reverse order of when the states left the Union. So you know who came home last. Anyway, in mid-June, Moses Levi walked home from Maryland with his other people from Manning, and he arrived there 40 years old, filthy, hungry, and to find everything he had almost lost. He rebuilt it, raised 9 children, educated those children, produced the next generation of professionals, and the family has grown and grown since then. But thank you so much for letting me share the story.
I just want to note that Sylvia's books are available here, and they'll be available at the reception at Addlestone as well.
Thank you. I'm Jenny Rosenberg Faulknight. Some of you probably know Evelyn Rosenberg Brine, who has been a loyal attendee here through the years. She said for me to please tell everyone hello, and she's sorry to miss this. Evelyn also told me that she was feeling like she needed to pass the torch in terms of being the family historian, and somehow it landed in my hand. So I don't think that I'll ever do as much as Evelyn did, but she has left us with a rich history. And it starts with the wine stocks, Moses and Eva Leah coming over. Well, Moses came first, and his wife, Eva Leah, was to follow him with the 2 children and actually endured 2 shipwrecks before she could get here and got back on the ship that third time to get to the United States and be with Moses. Somebody commented not too long ago when I told him that story, said, "No wonder you're so stubborn." I grew up immersed in family history. My father was Philip Rosenberg, who was one of the Abbeville Rosenbergs. And there were Abbeville Rosenbergs and Greenwood Rosenbergs. Weinstock and Pazanska were names that I just thought went along with. I thought our name was Weinstock, Pazanska, Rosenberg. But the stories that Daddy told us and the history that he collected about the family have just been invaluable. The Rosenberg Mercantile Company opened in 1872. It was established by Philip Rosenberg and G.A. Pazanska. And they were there, the store stayed in the family until 1985, I believe it was, when the store finally closed. Daddy was sick, and the establishment of malls was what did Main Street, small town Main Streets in, and it got us too. But it was a wonderful, wonderful way to grow up. Everything, it seemed like, that we had around had a story to it. The family silver, which the Greenwood Rosenbergs had, but it's in the story about when Sherman came through South Carolina. G.A. and Philip moved all their wealth that was stored in warehouses in Charleston to Columbia, because they thought that Sherman would most likely hit Charleston. But of course, he came through Columbia and destroyed I can't even think of how many warehouses full of cotton and grain and those kind of things. And I even have a letter at home where my grandfather, Saul Rosenberg, wrote the federal government asking about the reimbursement that we were entitled to. Nothing ever came of it. But anyway, also with the silver, when Sherman's troops came through Columbia, it's in the booklet, I think, that y'all have, but they came into the home and sat down and ate Sabbath meal with the family, and then told everybody to get out, and they burned the house down with everything in it. But one of the children's nannies had gathered up silver and put it under her big hoop skirts, and the children all gathered around her, and that was saved. And it was always part of our family history. As far as the most important thing to me is, growing up in a small town like Abbeville, we were the only Jewish family. And I never knew, I never really knew anybody who was Jewish. And that was, it was a blessing to me and for the people that I grew up with, because what they have always said since then is when they heard any anti-Semitic remarks is, well, Jenny's Jewish and she's just like everybody else. So it was a great way to grow up. And I guess that's all I need to say right now. Thank you.
I'm Arthur Berger, and I'm descended from both the Levis and the Rosenberg-Vizenska Weinstock line. I grew up in the 40s, and I grew up much of that time in the old family house that my grandmother had inherited, Irene Rosenberg Levi, and she tended to live in the past and talk very much about the family. And so I heard from the time I was old enough to understand English just what various ancestors did and what various members of the family were doing all across the United States, because she kept in touch with the relatives in New York, the relatives in Texas, the relatives in the Carolinas, and the relatives that she knew about from all of the branches of the family. It was an unusual family in several ways. One, according to family legend, we were important people in lineage, and my cousin Ernest, who had the middle name of Royal, would often come over to the house on a Sunday afternoon when the store was closed in Greenwood, and he and my grandmother would talk about family history and family connections for many generations. And my grandmother was probably the last one in the family who really kept up with all of the branches. She could say about this person out in Texas, well, she's only a third and a fifth cousin, but her husband was a first cousin, and you know, she knew it all. And later in life, when she was still able to remember most of this, another distant cousin, Morton Rose, came down, and he was doing a big family history, trying to trace all of the lineage back for umpty-ump generations, and she was one of his major sources. And I used to sit on the front porch of the old big house in Abbeville and listen as he asked questions and she replied, and through that I learned a lot of family history and the importance of it. I can't say that I remembered many of the details, though, I am unfortunately able to have to say, but it was part of my life, and living in a big old house without many other Jewish people around, except for the relatives, and of course her father was one of them. Family was something that was part of just everyday life, and generations of family were part of my everyday life. There were ghosts in every little bit of furniture in the house, as my grandmother would take me around the house, and every piece of ceramics or whatever in the house had a name on the bottom of it as to who it was to go to. The silver, the little bowls, the paintings, everything was named for a successor, because you were part of a line, and that line went back a long ways and hopefully continue a long ways. And so I became a historian. And one of the reasons I probably became a Chinese historian was that it was another ancient history that I, in that case, knew nothing about until I started studying it. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Ernie Marcus. I'm actually Arthur's brother. And I also say that because I was the youngest of the four, there were very few objects left for her to put my name on at the end, which I always resented. Anyway, I was involved in writing a couple of the articles, one on the Weinstock, Bizanska, Rosenberg, and I am the last one to talk about that, and also about the Levi's. My wife wanted to know if I was going to talk about my obsession with, or actually, idolatry, Jewish family objects and the homeland, and the answer is yes, I am. And what choice do I have? Because I, really all four sides of our family were from South Carolina, and they were all different. They were Eastern Europe, Germany, that is Bavaria, Russia, and you know they were from the really Yiddishkeit Orthodox in South Carolina, as well as the more refined Levi's and Weinstocks and so forth. So it was really an interesting experience. Dale had wanted us to talk about the meaning of family history to me, and I, you know, this is my Our Mother on the front cover. And history was always a connecting thing between us, even for arrowhead hunting and old bottle collection and listening to stories and eating wonderful family recipes or the results of. And so I think that the family history is a way to stay connected to her. She passed away almost 20 years ago. And for me, it's really important. And for my dad, last year I wrote an article in the publication about searching for Mayor Marcus from Utahville. And I think that was really trying to get to know him better, because he was somewhat of an enigma to me as a young kid about what actually he did as a mayor for 25 years. But by searching through family history, I was really able to learn a lot more than I ever knew before. I just wanted to go through some brief background of some of these sides of the family, because I think it's interesting about it goes from the plethora of information we have from the Weinstocks and so forth, and the very little information I have from others. Like the Marcus family, my grandfather came as a peddler from Lithuania to Utahville because there was a big sawmill there, but he died in 1917. So therefore, we know very little about the Marcus family. There were a number of them in King Street, and most of what I know about them I learned from the issue last spring, I guess, about included the Marcus family in King Street. What I learned about my dad as a mayor, I learned through interviewing the mayor of Utahville today, who went through some old records. I found some old newspaper articles, and there were stories that I remembered. But that was about it. There really was no written history. Then there was the Cohen-Karish family, which was also from both Maysville and Utahville. And there was a very rich family, Orthodox, and there were large families that were in Utahville, all living in the same house. So the connections that they feel back to, you know, the shtetl almost, is really incredible. But again, not much written history. It's really an oral history passed down, and stories told at family reunions and bar mitzvahs and funerals. And it still lasts to this day. Many of them are still in Washington, where I live. And we get together every year for Seders, and it's, you know, we're the great-great-grandchildren of the guys that came to Utah from Europe, and we're still meeting. It's like recreating the Seders of Utahville in Washington. I want to talk about two families that are in the show, the Levi's that we talked about earlier. Our grandmother that Arthur was talking about separated, essentially divorced, Louis Levi in about 1917. And then he died in the 1930s. So even though there was some communication with the Levi family, I certainly, growing up, didn't know much about them There were some newspaper articles that seemed very impressive and a very accomplished group. They didn't really know very much. Many of you may have been at the conference in Columbia for the Southern Jewish Historical Society, and there was a trip that was in Sumter to see the synagogue and also to go to the Levi home. So I said, what the heck, I'll go. And I was looking at a painting of Moses Levi, and Tricia Greenberg was saying, this is my great-great, or I guess her great-great-grandfather. I said, well, that's my great-grandfather. And so this started a whole conversation, and I ended up going with Madeline, my wife, to the Florence conference last fall, I guess, and spent the weekend with all these new relatives and met Patty Barnett, who had some great stories about the Levi's, and now it's continuing, so it's never too late. Then there's the Weinstock-Rosenberg-Bazanska families. I think you've heard quite a bit. I just wanted to talk about the research that's been done. It was not only Morton Rose that Arthur had mentioned earlier, there, as well as Evelyn. There was also a guy, an very orthodox guy in New York City, Yossi Loeb, who's related, who's done an entire book. I mean, he's totally obsessed with it. Hattie Bleser, that Karen had mentioned earlier, luckily is our relative, and she's doing an amazing amount of research, so we're very lucky for that. But obviously there's a family tree going back centuries. There's tons of stories, there's records, there's photos, there's journals, scrapbooks. So here there was a whole huge amount of information. Evelyn had done a pamphlet in the 1960s which talked about the family. It was a very thin pamphlet, but that's what really got me interested. And I think, first of all, being in Grandmom's home, the huge Victorian house, which she lived alone, with all the furniture and the books and the china and the scrapbooks, I think as a kid from tiny Utahville, South Carolina, this was a big deal. We were the only Jewish family in town. So I think being exposed to this great family, very accomplished, I think really set up a role model for me that was otherwise missing. And it was very important. Thanks.
Well, I was wondering when I was going to get the microphone. Well, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Nathaniel Mercer, and I am the son of Dr. Albert Mercer. I'm kind of filling in for him today. He was not able to make the trip down here from Kentucky for the event, so I'm going to be filling in for him. So anyway, I am the great-great-great-grandson of Simon Baruch, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the Baruch legacy. Simon Baruch came to the United States from Prussia around 1885, and he resided in Camden, South Carolina. He was a Surgeon General in the Confederate Army. He was also a pioneer of hydrotherapy in the United States for when he moved his career and family from South Carolina to New York. Simon had four sons, Hartwig, Herman, Salink, and probably the name most of y'all are familiar with is Bernard Baruch. Bernard was, a very famous businessman, philanthropist, and an advisor for Woodrow Wilson and other presidents going forward. From a personal standpoint, I gained much more knowledge about my Baruch heritage when my parents and I visited a portion of People exhibition in Charlotte, North Carolina, in New York City. And currently, I reside here in Charleston, South Carolina. My parents just bought a second home over on Ashley Avenue, which is about walking distance from the Baruch Auditorium, three blocks to be exact. My dad and I visited Cummins Street Cemetery about a year ago to visit the grave of our distant relative, Ravi Hartwig Cohen, for whom my grandfather, and uncle were named after. We have decided to embrace our heritage here in Charleston to live and to grow. Heritage bears responsibility for current behavior and future decision-making. As I see it, our lives and futures are in part determined by our past, our family, and community heritage. That's how appropriate for today's forum title, our families, and ourselves. Thanks.
Hello, my name is Laura Moses. I'm from Sumter, South Carolina, the daughter of Robert Altamont Moses and Harriet Elizabeth Pace. My father is Jewish, and my mother was Protestant converted to Catholicism. I have four sisters, and we were all raised Catholic. It did not stick. Today, we are two atheists, two no label, and one Jew. I'm one of the atheists, also a Unitarian and secular humanist. Growing up, we would go to St. Anne's with my mother on Sunday and often to Temple Sinai with my father on Friday. Temple was more of a social outing for me. I would say all the prayers, look around at the stained glass windows, and enjoy the oneg afterwards. But I didn't think of myself as Jewish, more like an honorary member. My mother was an honorary member too, even serving as president of the sisterhood. Most of my parents' friends were Sumter Jews. My mother had moved to that small town in the 1940s, having grown up in Kansas City, Missouri. Talk about culture shock. My mother's ancestors, the few that we know of, were from Scotland, Ireland, and Wales, and came to the States in the 1700s. My father's family is incredibly well documented, and I feel so lucky to have this wonderful genealogy book. This is the book. Sorry, I can't read and write a book at the same time. Okay. My father's Aunt Kathy had it made for him by Jamie Revel in Sumter, who kept all her records on index cards. The Sumter County Museum has her archives. It follows my father's family through his mother's and father's side back up sometimes 10 generations. Different sections here, and each section has a page for a person. Naming Sephardic ancestors from Spain and Portugal, as well as from England, France, and Germany, many of whom came to New York, Savannah, or Charleston in the 1700s. It is one of my most treasured possessions. My sisters also have copies, and my cousins. I also have a lot of family photographs. This one is identical to the one lent by my father for the exhibition at the Addlestone Library. The little boy with curls is my grandfather, Henry P. Moses, with his three older brothers, Vivian, Emil, and Herbert. This one is Herbert. Herbert was the only one I knew, and we called him Unc. My grandfather died young. This is a picture of me as a child with Unc in his garden. We used to go there every Sunday after church. Our family names in the case at the library include Harvey, Moses, Moes, Cohen, Emmanuel, and Satius. We are fortunate to have portraits or photographs of many of our ancestors, along with letters and diaries that give us a glimpse of their lives and their thoughts. Thank you.
And we're all cousins. Well, I am a Moes through and through. When you grow up on Moes Drive, and almost everybody for several blocks around is either a Moes, a Harvey, a DeLeon, Solomons, Lazarus, Lopez, or Moses, you're all cousins. Well, you get the picture. Plus, I was named for my grandmother, Anita Harvey Moes, who played a major role in my early years. And then there was Aunt Nina, who was the niece of our poet, Penina Moes. She absolutely ruled the family with lessons in community service and, of course, the famous Moes family parties at 29 Warren Street, General Edwin Warren Moes' house, which creaked with the ghosts of all our ancestors. So looking back to the 1700s, Charleston was a small, prosperous Jewish community where religious freedom was written into our colony, then state's, constitution. A synagogue was needed as the men worshipped in people's homes. So in 1749, Kahal Kadosh Beth Elohim was founded. Our extended family became part of those who worshipped on Hazel Street in a rented building owned by the Tobias family. In 1776, many of our family names can be found among those who served in the American Revolution. Marx Lazarus is my ancestor who qualifies me for the Daughters of the American Revolution, the DAR. In 1791, Abraham and Sarah Moise and four of their children arrived here from Santo Domingo to join this thriving Jewish community. In 1794, a large, impressive synagogue was built on Hazel Street. That building burned in the Great Fire of Charleston in 1838 and was replaced by member and builder David Lopez, who was married to ancestor Rebecca Moise, second wife. That makes us the ninth generation, makes me the ninth generation to be Jewish here in America. In 1824, my three-greats grandfather, Isaac Harvey, author, playwright, reviewer, teacher, and Abraham Moise II, my other great-grandfather, who was the second Jewish lawyer to be licensed in South Carolina, both of them born in Charleston, were leaders and presidents of the Reform Society of Israelites, with much of the Reform liturgy composed by them and my three-greats aunt, poet Penina Moise. The 47 men in that society are credited with bringing ritual reforms into the lengthy Sephardic Orthodox service, acknowledged as the first effort toward Reform Judaism in America. The Jewish community was severely divided over these reforms and created a new synagogue, Sherith Israel. Others moved upstate for better economic opportunity and founded Temple Sinai in Sumter, the first of the Moise family to leave Charleston. So back in Charleston by 1866, great uncle Charles Henry Moise helped negotiate a truce which brought Sherith Israel and Beth Elohim back together, and he served as their president. Down through the ages to modern times, when both my parents served Temple Sinai as presidents and as volunteers in all community efforts, their lessons in community service were always a part of our upbringing. My family's part in the deepest roots of South Carolina Jewry is ingrained in my everyday life and thoughts. We talked about furniture. This is Esther Lyon Moise's bracelet. My house is full of portraits. The kids call it the museum. It's full of furniture. We eat breakfast every day at the general's breakfast table. And the furniture is all part and parcel of how we live. People take the portion of the people, credit to you, really gives that kind of continuing thought process that we pass from generation to generation. So to Dale, we owe a tremendous thanks for just waking us up, because we grew up with all this and we didn't think a thing about it until she woke us up. So when I do tours of KKBE, where I'm the current president, and of Cumming Street Cemetery, Saul Brevart said to me, of blessed memory, "Being a Moise, there are very few people in the Cumming Street Cemetery who are not related to you. It is your responsibility to keep their stories alive."
Hello, I'm Ellen Eisden. I'm delighted to be here, and I thank you so much for your Southern hospitality inviting me. I live in New York City, where I was raised and where a part of my family has lived for more than six generations, and in tandem with Karen Franklin, produced an article for the current issue of the Jewish Historical Society of South Carolina, which is in your packets here. What catalyzed my interest in family genealogy really was my wonderful late father, Joseph Eisman, who was an attorney with the firm of Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton & Garrison in New York City, and had a sharp, intuitive mind. He started tracing his Eisman roots here in a very serious way in the 1980s, and he did it without the internet and by traveling to Europe and by traveling really all over this state and in various states across the country. And he connected the dots in a number of very key ways, showing how after much corresponding with the German archives that our family on his side, on the Eisman side, had all come together in the same generation to South Carolina. And we just went yesterday, for example, to Darlington. It was very exciting for me with my cell phone and my friend to be taking pictures of Eisman Road. It was really one of the great moments of my recent roots tracing. But my dad donated significant research to the collection at Attleston, which I had the good fortune to be shown this morning by Dale, and I'm very grateful for her efforts in, and Karen's as well, in bringing it all together so easily to comprehend for not just myself, but for other users who might want to have access to the information. On my late mother's side in New York, Marjorie Frankenthaler Eisman, I've also been catalyzed to engage in genealogical research efforts along with my brother. As her father, Alfred Frankenthaler, a judge in New York, died when she was only 18, and her younger sister, my aunt, the artist Helen Frankenthaler, they had no idea where their forebears had come from, and they wanted to find out where in Germany they had hailed from. My mother's stories about her very lively family that she shared with us as children, some of which she wrote about as a professional journalist, got us very hooked, very young, and she regaled us with very lively tales about her both immediate family and several generations back, all living in New York. On my father's side, he also had a very lively cast of characters, including a relative, Billy Seaman, who was friends with then-Mayor Walker, and James Thurber wrote a piece about the duo for the New Yorker magazine. And his grandfather, Joey Seaman, founded a dry goods company, White Rose, which is still extant today. In fact, I see the trucks all over Manhattan, but it's no longer, the ownership has been transferred. And my father also told us a lot about his mother's cousin by marriage, Rube Goldberg, the cartoonist. And we have many cartoons and books by Rube, and he later became a sculptor, and had various gallery shows, which we have too. So it's been a marvelous, fascinating journey back in time, which is still in progress, and a very wonderful personal way for me to reconnect with my parents, who are much missed and much loved. Thanks.
I'm Eileen Rabin Sirota, and I'm honored to be sitting here on this panel with such a roster of very distinguished families from South Carolina. I'd say we're probably more of the newcomers on the block, but my mother was a Mazo, and I'm here representing the Mazo family, as is my brother. I also want to thank Dale so much, because she really was the catalyst and got me started on researching our family history. And had it not been for Portion of the People, for which I was privileged to attend with both my parents before they passed away in New York at Yeshiva University, I might never have realized all the truth of the Mazo family history. So as it goes, I'd just like to say there were three Mazo brothers, my grandfather being one of them. The first one, they all came from Minsk. The first was David Mazo, who came to Charleston. In fact, I spent half the day with Dale on Thursday at the library and found out from the Charleston directory that both David and my grandfather Elihu were listed in 1907 in the directory as having had delis in Charleston. And one was at 171 King Street, and my grandfather's started out at 484 King Street and wound up buying his building in 1926 on King Street, and that became the family Mazo, the Mazo family home at 478 King. They were here at the turn of the century, more or less. I think they started out in New York and then ultimately made their way down to Charleston. But the third brother didn't come over until 1922, and his name was Gershon, but it became Americanized and became George. And he and his wife Sonia, when they first came, had to live with my grandfather and grandmother with a host of children in the house, because my mother was one of 10. There were 8 girls and 2 boys. And the ages, they were all born in terms of their chronological age. There was first Betty, who was born in Russia, and she came over. She was the mother of Harriet and Elihu Spicklum. Then there was Mary Bodney, and Mary Mazo Bodney ultimately married my Uncle Ben, and they moved to New York and bought the Algonquin Hotel and became a very literary family. And then there was my Aunt Sid, who stayed in Charleston, my Aunt Florence, who was called Boomily, who's all of her children are here today, her daughter Marilyn Hoffman, and Ellen, and Barry, and Norman Nierenblatt, and his wife Rebecca. And then there was my mother Annie, who married, Bradley, who is an orthodontist in Charleston as well, so all of our families well represented there still. And then there was my mother Annie, who married my father, Leon Raven, in 1939, and Daddy came here and established his business with my mother at his side, and it was Leon's Menswear, and they were on King Street for many, many years until we sold the building in 1999, and my brother will address that aspect of our growing up. My father was as my grandfather Elihu was instrumental in starting the Orthodox synagogue on Rutledge Avenue, Bris Shalom Beth Israel. My father, when everything, there were only 2 synagogues, the Reform and the Orthodox, and then when the Reform, when a lot of people wanted to become more conservative in their orientation, my father was instrumental in starting Temple Synagogue Emmanuel, which was located originally on Gordon Street. So the area in that part, the northeast section of Charleston, became a very much of a Jewish ghetto because a lot of Jewish families did live there, and we still maintain our house on Grove Street. Then we had Aunt Minnie, whose son Owen Mislin still lives in Charleston. And then we had my Aunt Celie, who moved to New York and had her 2 children, Uncle Sammy, Norma, and Donald, who also lived down here in Charleston. So those were the 10 children. And the census of 1920 shows that 5 children were living with Elihu Mazo and Essie Mazo at 83 Mary Street. And it's interesting that it was 83 Mary Street because many years in 1970, my mother and father, my mother especially, found out that there was a property on King Street that was for sale, and one address, it comprised 4 addresses, 85 Mary, 488, 490, and 492 King Street. And she went across the street and she said to my father, Leon, I'm going to buy this property. And she bought it because it reminded her that where she first started out living, which was 83 Mary, and one of the properties was 85. And it was not until 1926 that my grandfather did purchase his building at 478 King Street, which became known as Mazo's. It was a gourmet grocery store and a meat market. In 1922, as I said, the last brother came over, and he was the George Mazo and Sonia are the mother and father of Earl Mazo, Francis Mazo, and Norma Mazo. And Earl Mazo, as you probably know, worked for the Washington Herald Tribune and wrote the book on Nixon. And his 2 sisters, Norma and Frances. One, Frances, was the translator of Sholem Aleichem in this country. And Norma Mazo is a painter and a poet. And she actually has a painting in the archives at the library. So, and Dale was so proud to be able to have purchased that painting as well.
On eBay.
Okay. My great uncle David was also a pioneer on Folly Beach, and he also had a little grocery store there. And in the exhibition roadshow, you will see a picture of my mother standing in front of D. Mazo Fancy Groceries, that Dale has put together, for which I am so very grateful. It brought me to tears on Thursday when I saw it. My grandfather, Elihu, was reputed to be enormously kind-hearted, and he always gave food to those in need, whoever was hungry. He never questioned the veracity of any of his customers. If they said they had only 10 eggs, my grandfather would say, fine, whether they had 12 or 24, it didn't matter. He knew that if they were hungry and they felt, if they were feeding a hungry family and they couldn't afford to pay him, it didn't matter. He was interested in letting them eat, and that was it. Both David and Elihu were listed as peddlers upon their arrival, but it was interesting because my mother always told me that my grandfather had enough, her father had enough money to actually buy and start a business. So I guess they peddled well on their way in. after my grandfather died in 1939, the business was taken over by my uncle, Al Spickler, Harriet Spanier's husband, her father rather, and he ran it as a restaurant. It became a very important place for businessmen on King Street to have their lunch. And in our research of the family history, that addresses the Mazo family and where we come from. My brother and I were brought up by two incredible parents whom we miss to this day, both my mother Andy and Leon Rabin. Daddy was a very important merchant on King Street. He was president of the Retail Merchants Association and contributed a lot to Jenkins Orphanage all throughout his life. I still find people that know Daddy and had great respect for him from the people that helped me sometimes with the luggage at the airport to various and sundry others. And my brother and I are proud to be here representing the Mazo family and the Rabin family. And I'd like to turn this over to my brother now and let him speak.
Thank you all. Thank you.
Thank you.
I really...
You notice I left the New Yorkers for the end.
My sister convinced me to come here, and I'm so proud to be here with all of y'all. I'm a little shook.
Use the microphone.
I won't need it when I catch
Use
myself.
Use the microphone, please.
My dad, well, when I saw the picture of my mom at the library the other day, I always knew she was hot, but boy, was she hot. I really didn't know that picture existed, so I suggest you all see it, even all of us who are a little over age to look at pictures like that. I grew up with my father in his business. My dad came, my dad was in school, and in 1933 or 34, the stock market was in bad shape. And his father and his father's brothers were in the couture business in New York. They actually made my mother's trousseau when she got married. I'll never forget the gorgeous, gorgeous black flannel skirt and top with a mink trim. I'll never forget that.
My daughter has it and wears the jacket proudly.
It's gorgeous. It's still gorgeous, and it's 50, 60, 70 years old. Anyway, he pulled up in front of Mazo's Delicatessen on King Street in a 1937 Burgundy Buick, gets out of the car with pomaded hair, a wax mustache, pony skin shoes, and New York license plates. And there was my mama, coach of the choral, member of the captain of the Courtney School basketball team, dribbling a basketball. I wish I had the picture. I have it somewhere. Dribbling on the curb, and then my father comes out there. Oh, she's cute. My grandmother's looking through the window, Grandma Essie, and she goes out and she looks at him and sees the hair, the mustache, the shoes, the car, and the license plates, and she says, get in the store. Get in the store. You don't talk to men who look like that a year later. Well, let me jump back, because he was such a great... He got a job at Joseph H. Coyne & Sons in New York after the market crashed and became the super salesman. So they gave him the territory of North Carolina, South Carolina, in Tennessee, and we still have letters from the William McKinley Hotel in Tennessee to my mother, his love letters. She never wrote them back. She didn't like her handwriting. Her handwriting was beautiful, as was she. So anyway, a year later, after the incident with the convertible, he comes back in a black four-door Chevrolet, wingtip black shoes, no more pomade, And the mustache was still there because he had to have age in order to sell Bluestein's or Jack Krawcheck or any other place. And they got married, had the two of us, and I grew up with his legs, grew up with his feet. Used to drive me to the store. And in 1951, after one of his, he was renting a store next to the Mazo Delicatessen. They raised his rent, and I know about stuff like that. And he built the first air-conditioned store in the Southeast in 1951. And if you want to see, I think there's a blow-up of this somewhere at the museum, but this thing here, the shirts were $2.95, the suits were $10.23, etc. And he would drag me to the store and teach me how to sweep, teach me how to count. At first, there was not much to count, but later on, it became a nice kind of count. But I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stay still. I graduated from the Citadel in 1964, having no idea what I wanted to do. I went into the Army, got out as an officer, came back to Charleston, lost three of my classmates in Vietnam, and I moved to New York to sort of get lost. I wound up, a cousin of mine, or not a, sort of a cousin-in-law, Andrew Ansback, who just passed a week ago, got me a job or an interview with a fellow named Mel Jacobs, who at the time was the vice president of Bloomingdale's. I began at Bloomingdale's, and 2 years later, I began to design for Pucci, De Laurentiis, Givenchy, et cetera, et cetera. And after that, I said, you know what, if I'm going to work this hard, I'm going to work for me. And I bought a bankrupt store on 80th and 2nd Avenue. And 35 years later, all these years later, from my ancestors who were peddlers, we now on Madison Avenue, la-di-da, where I pay huge rent. Anyway, just to tell you about an incredible life here in Charleston, growing up with my sister. Nikki lived across the street from me. We all ran around together. We played baseball together. We did all kinds of stuff together. I got down here and I heard a lot about my reputation that I thought people forgot about, but they didn't. And other than that, I probably left stuff out. But you know what? I thank you all, and I love being Jewish now more than ever before, and I hope we can all continue to keep our heritages going. Thanks very much.
This is a fabulous group of people, and everybody stayed on time, so we still have 20 minutes, Marty? We have nearly 30 minutes for questions and answers. I know there are stories in the audience, too, and feel free to contribute about these families or other families. Anybody want to start, get the ball rolling? Okay, I'm going to ask my one provocative question here. Does anybody have any skeletons in the closet that they want to talk about? There are ghosts in the attic. I know that from Arthur, but there must be some.
Lots of ghosts.
Ghosts or skeletons?
I'm the only skeleton I know.
I remember a story about Aunt Belle Fazanska.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. She was a refined lady and apparently got sick, ran a high fever, was out of commission for a while. When she came to, she cussed like a sailor. And they never knew where Aunt Belle had ever heard any of the language that she was using then. But she was one of our more eccentric family members. We had quite a few.
You want our
There's a story about Moses Levi, who had an African-American man who worked for him for a good many years. And one day some lawmen from Columbia came into Manning and arrested him. And it turned out that he had been convicted of larceny in Darlington County some years before. And Raymond Wilson was the man's name, and this is from a newspaper article now, and this was in 1890. He was in the state penitentiary in Columbia. He had gone to work in the governor's mansion as a trustee, and he said he looked around and he realized that
just some days people walked off, and he decided he would walk off too. So he walked away and somehow wound up in Clarendon County, where he had worked for Moses Levi for a good many years. At any rate, Moses was very distraught over this because this person was very, very important to him. So he gathered petitions from people in town. He got the local sheriff, and he caught the train to Columbia and appealed to then-Governor Moses, and managed to get Raymond somehow freed immediately, and he took him back on the train to Manning that afternoon. And it was interesting, as I read Moses Levi's will, that years after that, he only mentioned three people who were not children in the will, and one of those three people was this man that he had gone to bat for in Columbia, and he left him the right to live on the farm and collect the rents and the produce and all from that farm. So thanks to reading old newspapers, we have stories about people.
We have a ghost story about Benjamin Franklin Moyes. Benjamin Franklin Moyes was a newspaper man, and he was very successful, and he bought a big house on Rutledge Avenue, which is a beautiful house to this day. And he fell on hard times and had to sell his house. And he sold it to Ambassador Sotili, who was coming here with his family. So one day, years ago, a lady called up. Her name was Mrs. Thompson. She said, "I'm a Sotili. I am Ambassador Sotili's daughter. And we bought your ancestor's house on Rutledge Avenue. Would you come one afternoon, have a toddy, and visit with us, and I will tell you the stories of your ancestors?" So I didn't know whether to believe her or not. So I called my cousin Ben Moyes, who wrote the article with me, and I said, "Ben, you're going with me, and we're going to go meet this lady." So we did. We went one afternoon, and we had a wonderful afternoon with Mrs. Thompson, and visited the beautiful, beautiful Moyes house on Rutledge Avenue. And she said, "Now, I'm sure Mr. Moyes will not show himself to you because he's very shy. But when we were growing up, our father always said Mr. Moyes was so sad to have to leave his house that when he died, he came back, and he is our official house ghost, and you must treat him with respect." So she said, growing up, that when they would hear Mr. Moyes at cards with his friends in the parlor, their mother and father would send them up to the sewing room on the third floor so that they wouldn't disturb Mr. Moyes. And she said to me, "He will probably not show you, but he is here in this house, and if he wants you to know, he will." Well, years later, we were doing volunteer work for the Charleston Historic Association, and I was assigned with my friend Jean and Ann, and several of us were assigned to the house on Rutledge Avenue. I was thrilled. So the poor lady who had bought the house, she'd only been there about, 2 years, and she said, "Are you sure about all this? Because we walked in telling the story." I had brought her the documents of where Mr. Moyes had bought the house and who he sold it, and the whole thing was all documented with the price and everything else. So this lady is looking over all these things, and we're in the dining room, and I said to her something about the kids going to the sewing room to stay out of the way, and she got real pale, and she said, "How do you know about the sewing room? Nobody's allowed on the third floor of this house." I said, "I just know. And if he wants you to know that he's in the house, he will open that door, because that's what Mrs. Thompson had always told me." The door opened.
I think we have a question or comment.
Thank you. Many of you may remember when Paul Harvey was a national radio syndicate program once daily. Well, it was called The Rest of the Story. He told the story of Ben Bodney, how he succeeded and took his wife on a honeymoon to the Algonquin Hotel. And the rest of the story was that when he got married, Am I telling something right? Yeah, he got married, and eventually he bought this hotel. That was
the promised on his honeymoon. Their honeymoon, he promised Aunt Mary that he would buy it one day.
When
he made his fortune in oil here in Charleston, he went up to New York and bought the Algonquin.
Right.
And they moved their family. Barbara, they had two daughters, Barbara and Renee Mae.
Right.
And Barbara was 13 at the time that they bought the hotel.
But my rest of the story is that my father loaned Ben Bonney $100, which was a lot of money that day, to go on his honeymoon.
Certainly was.
Thank you, in absentia. That's a great story, man. And along with that same story.
Did he get paid back?
I got a quickie, but along with that same story, in 1955, my Uncle Ben was a major, major, major baseball person. And he was trying to keep the Dodgers in New York. And I had the honor to sit in the World Series dugout I was 13. In 1955, I sat in the World Series dugout. And from Casey Stengel to Mickey Mantle, all of them hand signed a baseball for me and gave it to me. And Dummy here played with this ball over the years. I still have the ball, but the ball don't have no signature. However, what I really wanted to tell you was during the racial period in Charleston, during the time of integration and segregation and laws and the Supreme Court, there was a fellow named Earl Eugene, who was in front of my dad's store at 497 King Street. He was 13 years old. He got hit by a car. No one went out to help. No one. My dad shut his store, picked him up, and took him to St. Francis Xavier Hospital, and takes him in his arms, and they would not let him in. And my father sat that little boy down, laid him down under the statue of Mary. And he looked at whoever was in charge and said, "It's up to you. Either save his life or else." And my dad left. Years later, when Earl got better, got a little older, he came to work for Dad. He later became a sergeant major in the Air Force. And I was on leave from the Army around 1966, 67. I'm home on Sunday morning, and there's a knock at the door. And we live at 40-6th Avenue in Charleston, Wagner Terrace. We still live there. And it was a knock. And who was there? It was Earl, a handsome guy with a white German wife. Okay. My mom answered the door. I was walking with her. She answered the door, and she was like in shock. And hi. And she runs back to my father, who was sitting at the table, says, "Leon, Earl's at the door." And my father said, "Invite him in." And she says, "But he's with a white woman." And my father says, "Invite him in." Invited him in. Sat down, had coffee. They were friends forever. He's still around. He was the first black sergeant major in the Air Force.
And when my father died,
they came.
We have a card that Earl sent both my mother and father. In fact, he came to the first funeral. My mother passed away, and then the card, he couldn't make it. He lives in Texas. So it's been a lifelong friendship from Daddy saving this little boy's life.
As your resident northerner, my son got married this past year, and his fiance's wife called me up, and she said, when our older daughter got married, we had this wonderful tradition. We put our marriage photo up, and we put her the grandparents' marriage photos. Do you have photos when you were married? And I thought about it a little, and I called her the next day, and I said, well, not only do I have my photos, I have my grandparents' photos, I have my great-grandparents' photos, I have my great-grandparents', I have the invitation. I even have the register of my great-great-great-grandparents from 1844. Would you like them? She thought about it and she said, I think the photo of you and your husband. I am really jealous of all of you and your interest, the fact it seems that some of your families might actually take some sort of interest in what you do. Maybe, no, not really.
Yeah,
perhaps. And I am really very jealous, and I thank you for all of your contributions.
Karen, haven't you figured out where Ernie's people came from in Lithuania? Didn't you tell me
Oh, yeah. You mean the wine stock?
Yeah.
Virbalis? Yes.
Yeah.
But there was another, you said that it was generically said Gerbania. You had figured out exactly where that came from?
Oh, yeah, we can talk.
I'd just like to say one thing before we close, if we do that. I think we owe an enormous debt of gratitude and a round of applause for Dale.
Sitting right here, who found tons of material, our intrepid researcher, who go back to her files all the time. But I really welcome everyone to walk over to Adelstein. He might have a few things to say. And we'll have an hour and a half to schmooze and look at the show and, I guess, vibe a little bit.
Bye.